Happy Independence Day for the ACLJ. Let's celebrate and defend our freedoms.
Keeping you informed and engaged, now more than ever. This is Seculo. We want to hear from you. Share and post your comments or call 1-800-684-3110. And now your host, Jay Sekulow.
Hey, everybody. We want to do a very special broadcast here because obviously we're still celebrating the tremendous victory in the overturning of Roe versus Wade in the Dobbs case. And as I said, our case, Bray versus Alexandria, served as the basis for that, where the court held an opinion by Justice Scalia that opposition to abortion was not discrimination against women. Our media teams have been putting together multiple documentaries on the abortion industry, because you have to understand that it is, in fact, an industry. And we've got some very, very unique interviews that you're not going to have, really probably couldn't get again on some of these, that really shows what the abortion issue is, because as it goes to a state, to the states, we still have to educate people about what that means.
Yeah, and there's still this big business there, and it is essentially the pro-abortion lobby going after this. They've done actually 4 or 5 different documentaries on the life issue, some historical, some about the future. Right. I do find it ironic that you have someone like Planned Parenthood who proclaims only 3% of what we do is abortion services. And now this weekend you see they're closing nationwide. They're having to close
clinics.
Because why? It may be 3% of the services provided, but it's certainly not 3% of the income they produce.
Yeah, that has been an interesting phenomenon, by the way. They talk about all these prenatal services they provide and breast cancer screenings they provide and ultrasounds and all of this. But when it comes to actually staying in business, once Roe was overturned, they immediately said, the clinics are closing.
Yeah,
We have no business model that'll make this work.
And our broadcast has never been about talking to talk. We've tried to continually make the broadcast more and more about something that even if you just tuned in for 5 minutes, from that 5 minutes, you can take something away that's different than talking heads on cable news or three-minute discussions.
You know, one of the things we sat down at the beginning of the year, we always evaluate at night, and we said to our team, and we had a big meeting with our production team and our folks that are on our broadcast, and said, when you speak, have something that you say that when it's over with, our listener says, I didn't realize that, or that I've never thought about it that way. And that's what we're trying to do each and every day in this broadcast. So we bring you our expert analysis. We bring you our expert team. What you see is a really nice studio and cameras and the lighting. What you don't see behind the screen is 6 or 8 people managing this broadcast for an hour to get it on the air. And then another group of people that are helping put content together as well. And then the social media department that gets us out into bites so we can get it on social media platforms all over the country. We have some of our pieces end up in the top 10 of Facebook shares. I mean, we know that. Even with the difficulty we've had dealing with free speech with Facebook. And that tells us that what it shows is our ability to get a message out. And then you hear from Than Bennett, and we're taking direct action in Capitol Hill, and Jeff Balaban, who's heading right back to our office in Jerusalem. So, understand the scope and nature of what's happening. And we are in our matching challenge campaign. So this is where you come in. And I'm going to emphasize what Jordan said. This is only if you're able to do this. If you're not in the financial position to do it, please don't. Pray for the ACLJ. Pray for our team. Encourage others.
You could sign petitions, share it,
engage on our social media. I know everybody can't afford it with the price of gas and food and fuel and everything else. But if you can, we really would appreciate your support for the ACLJ. We're in a matching challenge month. Jordan's going to let you know how to do it, folks.
Yeah, it's very easy to do. You go to ACLJ.org. That's ACLJ.org. Right on the homepage there, you can do it on your phone, you can do it on your tablet, you can do it on your computer. Very quick, though. I mean, by the time we come back from this break, you could have easily made the donation. And you'll see matching challenge or donate. Either one of those take you to the right page. Put in your info, choose the amount you want to donate. You can also choose if you want to make it a recurring monthly donation. That will still be part of the match. People ask that all the time, and that will be part of the match. So you go to aclj.org. This is a great time to support our work. As you said, we're grassroots. A $25 donation is a big deal for the ACLJ.
We'll be right back.
to Secular. We are joined now by Congresswoman Nancy Mace, South Carolina. And the Congresswoman, as we've been talking about these attacks on pro-life pregnancy centers, she serves as part of the Government Committee on Oversight and Reform, but specifically the Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. And Congresswoman Mace, let me welcome you to Secular, but first say, you are calling on the committee subcommittee chair, Jamie Raskin, to hold hearings on this violence against pro-life pregnancy centers that we have seen, whether it's spray-painted vandalism, whether it's firebombing. We saw another attack last night in Michigan, which included vandalism. And you said so far, as we've heard, it's just been like silence from the Democrats on this issue involving attacks on the pro-life pregnancy centers.
Yeah, and we've had several hearings on right-wing violence, but none on left-wing violence. And I will tell you, having been in a few of these hearings and having the FBI come and testify, they don't categorize these groups like Jane's Revenge or Antifa. They aren't even keeping track of that as a category of violence within the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And I'm someone who's been attacked by extremists. My house was spray painted last summer. I've had my car keyed. Having been a victim of political violence, we've got to look out for both sides of the aisle. And there have been over 40 attacks over the last couple of months of this kind of domestic extremism, and we ought to be having hearings about it. This should be equal opportunity to look at the kind of violence that we're seeing across the country. And then this week, with the advent or oncoming potential Roe v. Wade decision by the Supreme Court, we're seeing signs and threats of violence for people to act on those threats. And so this is something that's got to be nipped in the bud by both sides, and they got to do it. They need to do it immediately.
Congresswoman, one of the things that I have been very concerned about here, and I've articulated this a couple of times, and you're right, there's been, when you add the churches to the list of places that have been attacked for the pro-life positions, we're closer to 63. In fact, three that just got added in the last couple of days. But what I've been very, very concerned about, very troubled by, frankly, is the lack of action by the United States Department of Justice, by the Attorney General Merrick Garland. Has anybody on the Hill hearing anything from the DOJ on any of this?
No, we're not. It's been dead silence, like on every other important issue and crisis of Joe Biden's own creation that we've seen over the last several months. It's been very quiet, and that's not where we should be right now. We're seeing, you know, violence increase across the country over the last 2 years, and every city and every state has seen some form of violence. We're seeing shootings increase in my home state of South Carolina. And, you know, what are we doing about it? And how are we holding these people accountable? And it's churches, it's synagogues. I sat in on a briefing, security briefing 2 weeks ago for one of our local synagogues in Charleston. These are real issues facing real Americans, and they're not being addressed by this administration or this Department of Justice.
I mean, to me, it's ignoring, you know, Americans. Like, the pro-life pregnancy centers are so demonized, Congresswoman Mace, by the left. I feel like that's part of why this is a group, you know, in New York right now, three were firebombed and that, you know, real vandalism done, not just the spray painting. And at the same week as this Jane's Revenge group wanted, was putting out the message and saying, claiming they're going to do this, also calling for riots in D.C. the night the Dobbs decision comes out and the flyers all over Washington. But Congressman Mace, the day that was all occurring, they released a press release saying how they're going to try and shut down those pro-life pregnancy centers at the state level. We've seen them called horrendous names by some of your colleagues in Congress, calling them a mis- and disinformation centers.
Fraud.
So they're not being treated just like any other American's organization, lawful business that is under attack.
No, and you've seen Jane's Revenge claim responsibility for over 15 of the attacks that we've seen and brag about it. You have a president, Joe Biden, who won't condemn protesters showing up on the lawns of our Supreme Court justices because of the impending Roe v. Wade decision, which, by the way, is illegal to do. And, you know, more or less encouraging that kind of protest. And so, you know, we aren't following the law, like, at all in any of this, because they have a different perspective. And if women want to protect their baby or give their baby up for adoption or have family planning resources that doesn't kill their child, they ought to have access and safe access to those churches and faith-based communities who are providing those resources for those women. They should be equally protected as anyone who's showing up at any other Planned Parenthood or whatever. And that's not what's happening. And that's only further causing division in this country.
You know, you write in your letter to Jamie Raskin that the preservation of our democratic society demands that we take action to root out violence, no matter where it occurs and whatever its motivation is. You say we must be united in our efforts to preserve our civil society and contemn all violence. My question is this. We've had inaction by the Department of Justice. We've had no action by your colleagues in Congress. And we don't even have local action by the local police departments. You've got an organization, like you said, this Jane Revenge, which is calling for, quote, you said you'd riot. And crickets out of the Department of Justice on this. So I applaud you, we do, at the American Center for Law and Justice for taking the initiative to get this back front and center, because you're right, this is violent extremism targeting a viewpoint, which is unconstitutional. Your thoughts?
Well, when Republicans get in the majority later this year, we've got to make sure that we have these hearings, that we subpoena folks. When they don't show up, we hold them in contempt to get to the bottom of it and to bring our officials in the Department of Justice accountable for not addressing this issue. I want to know how they're going to address it, how they're going to protect our communities and keep them safe and keep women safe, no matter what their political viewpoints or their viewpoints are on life. And so it's going to be incumbent upon us to do that moving forward and to hold ourselves and each other accountable for getting this administration and the DOJ to get them to do what they're supposed to be doing, which is follow the laws in this country that were created.
I mean, it's like they love doing the hearings on domestic violent extremism. And I think that the only way that those become legitimate fully to the American people, as you've heard, you've sat through those hearings and there are legitimate concerns there. But when you ignore an entire half of that domestic violent extremism that comes out of the left, Congresswoman Mace, the American people don't take seriously the other side of the extremism either, which isn't good. And so if you're not going to look at it as a holistic approach and it's going to be all partisan, then people ignore it. And that's not good for America.
No, and it's both sides too. And you can't have one side holding one accountable and then you ignore the left altogether. That is not what we should be doing in this country. And that's one of the reasons that we have sowed so much division within our communities is how partisan this has been. And it's not been done in an equal way. And I think that at the very minimum is the low bar, right? Is to hold everybody accountable. You break the law, you should be held accountable no matter what, no matter what your political perspective is. And that's not what's happening in this country. And it's going to be coming upon Republican leadership and people like myself to move that ball forward and to do the right thing no matter what.
Congresswoman, we appreciate the stand you're taking on this. Thanks for being with us today. Very important. We'll keep please keep us engaged on this, informed. We're working on it too. Thank you for your help.
Thank you.
That's Congresswoman Nancy Mace of South Carolina. I want to go to the phones, 1-800-684-3110. We've got some calls coming in, too, on the gun safety laws, too. So let's go to Bob in Virginia on line one. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Bob. This is Bob from Virginia. I'm a retired police officer, and one of the things in Virginia we have is this red flag law, and what is disturbing is it denies you due process. My question is, do you think these laws will be challenged in court?
Yes, and I think it depends on the language. Some of the laws, Florida had, listen, people talk about Florida as being, you know, this super red, very conservative state. It has the red flag laws.
Yes, it does.
So you have to look at, I think, state by state. You know, what does Virginia's red flag law look like? What is the, you say it doesn't have due process. I mean, if it has no due process, it wouldn't have upstand at all. So it must have some, but does it have enough to survive scrutiny in light of the fact that we've gotten yet another very clear opinion out of the Supreme Court? I don't know how many times they're going to have to do it, but
they sure did it.
But
today.
It's because they're all the anti-gun world is always trying to come up with a new way to keep you from being a legal, law-abiding citizen with a firearm. You know, that's their focus. And every time they do that, they are expanding the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Second Amendment.
You know, it's interesting on this one, Andy.
But I do think there's going to be a lot of legal challenges to any of new legislation.
There's going to have to be. Any legislation, including red flag laws, are going to be very specific and narrowly tailored, is what the Supreme Court says.
Andy. Yeah, that's exactly what the court is saying. It's giving a very loud and clear warning, 6-3, that when you draft these laws, you don't have to give a good reason or just cause why you have to exercise a constitutional right. Who ever heard of that? As a preface to the exercise of the Bill of Rights, you have to show just cause or a good reason. And that's whether it is to carry a gun, whether it is to have a speedy trial, whether it has the right to speak on a street corner or a sidewalk, or to hand off leaflets. You preface it by having to show just cause, and you give the public official the discretion to determine whether the cause is just enough. That's not the American way. That's not what the framers said. And the Supreme Court of the United States hammered down on that today.
I will tell you, like, we're not like a lot of organizations in that we don't have, you know, we don't get a, we get some, and we're appreciative of everything. We're not, we don't get regularly $10 million grants and million dollar grants. That's very rare for us. But it's because of people like you. Lots of people like you. Thank you. Without your support, it doesn't happen. And as we said, we're in a matching challenge campaign. Jordan's going to let you know how to do it. It makes a big difference.
It's very easy to do. You go to aclj.org. That's aclj.org. You'll see matching challenge or donate. Either one of those take you to the right page. So you go to aclj.org. This is a great time to support our work. As you said, we're grassroots. You know, a $25 donation is a big deal for the ACLJ.
Later on, so give us a call at 1-800-684-3110. We're still talking about the border crisis, but we're going to be shifting in this segment to talk a little bit more about, obviously, a historic week for life, historic week as Roe's overturned. But now, as we expected, it's going back to the states, as the Supreme Court ruled, and that is going to be 50 new battles.
Literally. More than that, yeah. In states that, you know, we initially people thought, well, the states that have kind of a pro-life majority are going to be fine, and then the states that don't, you've got to work in. But Frank Manion, senior counselor for the ACLJ. Frank, you and I have been doing this work for, you know, I don't want to date us, but let's say 40 years. So that's a good number. We're thrilled with the decision in Roe. But right there in Kentucky, where your office is, you've got a challenge there. There's been one in Utah and Louisiana. And in Utah and Louisiana, the courts have issued temporary restraining orders, not allowing the pro-life legislation to go in effect even after the Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, Jay, and we're not shocked by that, I guess. And I don't hold out a whole lot of hope that the court in Kentucky will do anything different than the court in Louisiana and Utah. You know, Kentucky is generally considered a very conservative place. Supreme Court justices are elected. But in the past, and they've never confronted an abortion issue directly because it was a federal matter until Friday. So we don't really have a track record. But I have to say that, as you know, these cases are filed on the basis that the state constitution does protect the right to abortion, even if the federal doesn't after Dobbs. And there is a significant amount of right to privacy case law in Kentucky already, which is what the ACLU is banking on. They've already sued. They sued yesterday. They've obviously been waiting for this because, you know, the filings that they filed yesterday are, you know, they're from the ACLU National. This isn't the local Kentucky ACLU.
Okay.
They're changing the names of the states, you know, and the case law that they're citing. So they're ready to go.
Frank, I've said that a lot of this is going to ultimately come down to the state Supreme Courts. So like, take Kentucky, for instance. I don't know what the situation there is. How does your court view these issues?
I think I'm not that optimistic with the state Supreme Court because of their long history of sort of mimicking what the Supreme Court has done with privacy and, you know, bodily integrity and all that sort of thing. I could easily see them siding with the ACLU on this. But the good news in Kentucky is the issue is on the ballot in November. In November, we already have a referendum which will decide whether or not there is a right to abortion in the Kentucky Constitution. So in a sense, the court matter here, the litigation, is a bit of a sideshow because the voters are going to decide this in November, and Kentucky voters historically have been extremely pro-life. So I'm much more optimistic about winning there than I am about winning at the courts. But we'll see.
But then you also have a very liberal governor in Kentucky. Yeah. And a lot of our comments, a lot of people from Kentucky that are listening. So that does put a weird counterbalance. You think of Kentucky as a very conservative area, you know, elected officials you think would be representative, but Kentucky is kind of one of those anomalies where it can kind of go either way.
But Frank, you raised the point of the legislative initiative, and ACLJ Action, our 501c4, is looking at these states because we came to the same conclusion that you're not going to just be able to rely on the state Supreme Courts here, that it may take constitutional amendments in the state legislature to get through, that the people actually vote on these issues. So what does the fight look like in your view here? I mean, are we talking about 50 states probably or possibly?
It's quite possible. And yeah, I mean, this is exactly what Dobbs said. You know, people are freaking out about it. It banned abortion. Well, no, it didn't. It gave it back to the people. That's what, you know, the conservatives on the Supreme Court have been saying for decades. As you know, this is a matter that should never have become a federal judicial matter. It's a matter for the people to decide, and people in places like Kentucky, I suspect, are going to decide in a very pro-life way. Other states are going to decide differently, and, you know, that's the way it is. I will point out that, as Logan makes the point, that we have a liberal governor, but we have a very conservative attorney general who's completely at odds with the governor, so he is vigorously defending this particular law, Daniel Cameron. He also happens to be running for governor. You know, we've already reached out to his office and told him, you know, contact us if you want to make his support, anything else we can do. But I am very confident that that this law is going to get a top-notch legal defense from the attorney general's office. You know, sometimes attorney generals, when faced with laws they don't like, kind of put up a half-hearted effort in defending these things. But that's not going to happen here in Kentucky.
Yeah, like we said, Laura on YouTube said Kentucky has a very liberal governor. What is his role in this? So what about the conflict between the governor, Frank, and the attorney general?
Well, it's interesting because our current governor used to be the attorney general.
Right.
And when we had Matt Bevin as governor. So those two went at it all the time. And we're seeing sort of the reverse thing now with Beshear as governor and Cameron. Cameron has already announced, and I'm sure they're in the process of filing today, that they're going to vigorously defend this law. So I don't have any doubts that, you know, the governor doesn't have much to say about it at this point.
So the ACLJ action, just so everybody knows, is looking at it legislatively, constitutional amendments. ACLJ is looking at it from a litigation standpoint. Frank Mannion, senior counsel with the ACLJ, appreciate your comments on this and being with us. But I'll tell you this, Logan, this is exactly what we said was going to happen. Now, it's happening quickly, but we have been prepared too. The decision of the Supreme Court was great. It returns it to the states, and I think the fight's going to be in the states.
Yeah, and actually, I'd be interested to hear from people who are more pro-choice than the fact that I feel like they're putting their money and their time in the wrong places. You see people supporting Planned Parenthood. You see people putting their time at protesting when really it's the Supreme Court decision. It was what it was, and now it's where litigation is going to take place. It's where they're going to go to the courts to battle this out and inevitably go to the elections and upcoming elections when this happens. So that is, to me, an interesting part of this. I think people's natural reaction on either side is take to the streets and protest and donate to these organizations that really can do nothing. Even if you're a pro-choice person, they can't do anything right now. Supreme Court has ruled. So now it takes it to the court, and now it's going to get interesting. I hope people get more educated on actually where they need to be putting their support.
Well, I think that's right. And there's going to be a lot of talk right now, but and people are trying to rush statements out, and we're saying we have to do this thing very strategically, very wise, very smart. You look at a state like Kentucky, it's a perfect example. Republican AG, Democratic governor, conservative legislature, looks like a pretty liberal Supreme Court in Kentucky.
Yep.
So then you got to look and say, okay, well, we could go with that challenge up to the Supreme Court of Kentucky, but also we may need something else legislatively. And that's where it's going to take real analysis. And we've got teams of people working on this right now. I mean, literally teams of people in our office in Washington, in our office in Kentucky, around the country, to deal with these precise issues. So, again, I want to be clear that these are big issues. We're prepared. We're just being really strategic on how we engage this. None of this happens without you. And it's because of people like you, lots of people like you, that make a difference. That was what we decided to do 35 or 40 years ago when we started, that it was going to be more of a, we now call grassroots model, but it was really going to be supported by everyday citizens, the people that wanted to protect religious freedom, religious liberty, and protect our freedom and liberty as American citizens. And we have been blessed beyond anything we could imagine. And we have facilities that we can't even, when I'm wearing these facilities, I still can't believe we're in these facilities. But that doesn't happen without you. But I just wanted to stop and say thank you from all of us. There's a lot of people working behind the scenes, as you know, in that we don't have a camera back there. We should really get one. And around this entire office and our offices around the globe. Thank you. Without your support, it doesn't happen. And as we said, we're in a matching challenge campaign. Jordan's going to let you know how to do it. It makes a big difference on how we can proceed ahead.
Yeah, it's very easy to do. You go to ACLJ.org. That's ACLJ.org. Right on the homepage there, you can do it on your phone, you can do it on your tablet, you can do it on your computer. Very quick, though. And you'll see matching challenge or donate. Either one of those take you to the right page. Put in your info, choose the amount you want to donate. You can also choose if you want to make it a recurring monthly donation. That will still be part of the match. People ask that all the time, and that will be part of the match. So you go to ACLJ.org. This is a great time to support our work. As you said, we're grassroots. You know, a $25 donation is a big deal for the ACLJ.
At the American Center for Law and Justice, we're engaged in critical issues at home and abroad. For a limited time, you can participate in the ACLJ's Matching Challenge. For every dollar you donate, it will be matched. A $10 gift becomes $20. A $50 gift becomes $100. You can make a difference in the work we do, protecting the constitutional and religious freedoms that are most important to you and your family. Give a gift today online at aclj.org.
Keeping you informed and engaged, now more than ever. This is Seculo. And now your host, Jordan Seculo.
Now you know about the huge victory for life, the overturning of Roe versus Wade by the U.S. Supreme Court. Big victory for religious liberty at the U.S. Supreme Court. That for the coach, a case that took way too long. A high school football coach, public school coach, who after the game would go to part of the field and pray. This became a constitutional crisis because of someone claimed that their student was an atheist. I mean, even that was questionable because it wasn't the family. It was about the student. But okay, the student wasn't being asked to pray. The coach didn't say you must pray. And the coach didn't use those terms like if you don't pray, if you don't show up to this, you're not playing next week or you're running laps. Nothing like that. So the Supreme Court clearly in favor of the coaches. A free exercise of religion rights, but also First Amendment rights. And I think that is getting pretty clear on where the court is when it comes to religious liberty involving at least young people. So I know that some people in high school are starting to become adults at 18, but mostly they're looking at minors here.
Yeah, and importantly, I think, for this, is there was a legal test that was being applied for the Establishment Clause that was called the Lemon Test, and it was a disaster. It was this three-part test. You had to determine what was the secular purpose, was there entanglement, and what the court has replaced it with is history. And basically a coercion test. If there's not coercion involved, in other words, if the coach were to say, listen, I'm going to do this prayer, and if you participate in it, you're going to play football next week. If you don't participate, I'm not going to let you play. That would be unconstitutional. But if the coach just wants to pray, or if the students want to get meet together and pray, they have the right to do that. And that's what the court said. You can't use the mechanism of the government. You're not going to let you use the PA system. But you can. The students can. The entire stance could get up and say, the Lord's Prayer, which happened in Santa Fe in the case involving prayer at a football game, but you could not use the mechanism of the state. Constitutional. I'll tell you what I think would still not be constitutional. A minister, a rabbi, priest coming in before at the graduation ceremony and offering an invocation. Now, after the Town of Greece case, it's a little bit suspect. I think there may be some wiggle there, but the court, in this opinion, did not indicate that. That anything where you've got compelled attendance for students would be problematic. But the court acknowledged that students themselves have the right to do that kind of activity. For instance, a valedictorian of the class wants to give a speech and talk about their particular faith journey. They're going to be allowed to do that under this test.
Yeah, that's right. So again, we're taking calls on that. 1-800-684-3110. People still have questions, honestly. And I think fairly, we're going to be answering a lot of those questions for weeks on the what it truly means now that Roe versus Wade has been overturned. And how that's going to impact your state. So, I mean, you could go through literally 50 different broadcasts focusing on 50 different states. Yeah. We're going to be doing it as needed as your questions come in, but we're also going to be focusing in ACLJ action and utilizing the ACLJ's legal team on some states that are kind of right in the middle that need a little help. They need a constitutional amendment at the state level. They need to change some law. So it's not just that they don't just have a trigger law in place and they're ready to go. They need a little bit more work. They've got the votes. They've got the pro-life support of their state, but they've got to do a little bit more work. And we're going to be involved in those states very directly, firsthand, whether it's through advertising, lobbying, through ACLJ action, and of course, utilizing our legal team to put together those constitutional amendments that may need to be moved forward in your state. But mm-hmm. A lot of questions, a lot of calls about that at 1-800-684-3110. This was interesting. I think we can answer very quickly. Lori out of Arizona online too. Hey, Lori.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I want to ask you, with Roe Wade being overturned, does that mean that there will be no federal funding of Planned Parenthood?
No, that's a different battle, because Planned Parenthood technically can't use those funds to pay for abortions. Now, it's an accounting gimmick because it frees up another dollar for them to use to pay for abortions.
I will tell you, like, we're not like a lot of organizations in that we don't have, you know, we don't get a, we get some, and we're appreciative of everything. We're not, we don't get regularly $10 million grants and $1 million grants. That's very rare for us. But it's because of people like you. Lots of people like you. Thank you. Without your support, it doesn't happen. And as we said, we're in a matching challenge campaign. Jordan's going to let you know how to do it. It makes a big difference.
It's very easy to do. You go to aclj.org. That's aclj.org. You'll see matching challenge or donate. Either one of those take you to the right page. So you go to aclj.org. This is a great time to support our work. As you said, we're grassroots. You know, a $25 donation is a big deal for the ACLJ. Welcome back to Secular. We do want to update you on some of what's going on in the world, too. And, of course, we've had these major domestic court decisions, which, by the way, put us in line, especially Roe versus Wade, with the rest of the world. So that we're not an outlier country when it comes to infanticide like North Korea and China, which we used to be in that group. It used to be the United States, North Korea, and China that the federal national level had basically no restrictions on abortion. We're no longer in that bad group, if you will, that club. And we return now to really where most states and most of the restrictions we're talking about will be in line with where Europe is, including a lot of predominantly Catholic countries, including even Latin America. So, again, it puts us, it's more mainstream for the United States, actually, instead of being this extreme country that is associated with the worst human rights abusers when it comes to the abortion issue. But I want to go to Rick Riddell, our senior advisor for foreign policy and national security, because there's two big meetings. One is the G7, again, about economics, but of course, Ukraine as well.
Yeah, these are big issues that are on the plate for the G7. Obviously, the Ukrainians would like to see the G7 do a lot more. We clearly have seen the Germans talk about doing some more, but they haven't really. It's been shocking how little Europe has done, led by the Germans. They did this phony thing where they said, oh, we're going to put the Ukrainians into the application process to join the EU. And then the Germans quickly thereafter said, we would like to have more power on who becomes members of the EU, and therefore they will shut it down. So they're playing a little games. They're never going to let the Ukrainians into the EU, but they've announced that they get to at least fill out an application.
Rick, on the Ukraine situation with regard to Russia and the conflict, we talked before we went on with our military analyst, Colonel Wes Smith, and Wes said that, you know, Ukraine is suffering some real damage right now. I mean, there were more attacks in Kyiv, which have been pretty quiet for the last 4 months. How do you see that right now, that whole situation?
You know, Vladimir Putin is watching exactly what we're watching, with the Americans getting distracted with an abortion debate and a ruling. And I think that there's no question that the Russians and Putin will amp up, will go on the offense when they think that the West is distracted. You've got a G7 meeting. You've got, clearly, the Germans have sent a very loud message that they're not going to provide immediate weaponry to the Ukrainians. They're talking about doing it at the end of the summer. They're talking about delivering tanks that they really, the Ukrainians didn't request. So they see the distractions from the United States and from Germany and the rest of the West. And I think he's doubling down and going on the offense.
And then, you know, after the G7, we move into NATO, the NATO summit in Spain. And I know you talked already about this idea of playing, like, will Ukraine become part of NATO? Will it not become part of NATO? But honestly, what I'm hearing, Rick, which I think is something, too, that the United States and the American audience is hearing when we do cover this issue, is that it's months and months and months in advance now. It's like, well, in 2 months, this will happen, and maybe 6 months. And, like, a never-ending war is basically what I'm getting to. It sounds like we're at least on a path for many more months of bloodshed.
No one is better at bureaucracy and slowing down the process than the Europeans. They love to talk about this, and that's one of the frustrations I think that many Americans and others are having is that there's a lot of talk, but there's not a lot of action. When it comes to NATO, you know, I'll just reiterate it again. I just don't think that members of NATO who aren't paying their 2%, aren't paying the obligations that they signed up for, those members should not be voting on expanding the membership of NATO. Why are they getting to a vote to expand the responsibilities of the defense shield when they're not paying the current requirements and the current obligations that they have? Until every member of NATO is paid up and doing their fair share, I just don't think that we should be talking about expanding the alliance.
The other thing I wanted to move to, Rick, is the situation with Iran. And there was talk over the weekend that the administration wants to get back into this dialogue with the Iranians. The Russians have, I think, been kind of putting a little bit of a kink in their wheel there so that the Biden administration hasn't been able to move forward. But it seems like that President Biden and his team are committed to this idea of a deal with Iran, which is absurd to me, but it seems like where it's going.
Look, Foreign Minister Lavrov was just in Tehran. I think this is a sign that they're pressuring the Iranians to move forward with the blessing of the Russians. They're going to try to jam the Americans once again while the Americans are distracted. Look, the Russians, as you know, Jay, they want some help in Syria. They want to get out. They are fully responsible, but they want to dial back. They clearly are feeling overextended between Ukraine and Syria. And so they're trying to get another country to take over their responsibility, their role in Syria. They'd like the Iranians to do it. Obviously, that's not what the Israelis or the Americans want. And I hope that the Biden team is laser focused on making sure that no one takes advantage of us while we're being distracted at a high political level.
You know, Rick, you just texted me, but there was a lot of talk, and I think you can answer it because people are wondering why President Biden's ambassador to Germany was not there when he arrived. And people are speculating all this. You've done some work on this to be able to answer that question.
Yeah, unfortunately, the U.S. ambassador to Germany has tested positive for COVID and she wasn't able to join the president. I know she's got to be greatly disappointed that the president of the United States comes to Germany. She's not able to be there. It's kind of one of those shining moments. And a lot of work gets done between the Germans and the Americans if you have an ambassador that's kind of driving things forward. So she was not able to be there, and you know, our hearts go out, and I hope that she's going to be okay.
So, Rick, I wanted to ask you, I want to follow up on a portion of that, and that is you served as the U.S. ambassador to Germany. Germany is the most powerful economy in Europe. And give us a sense of what it was like dealing with your counterparts and the chancellor. What was your sense of that? I think it'd be very important for our audience to understand the nature of what goes on.
First of all, on a personal level, I loved Chancellor Merkel. She was very friendly, very nice, has a great sense of humor, and we could talk pretty openly and casually, and I enjoyed that. But there's no question that the Germans, I believe, and I articulated this very clearly, moved away from the Western alliance over the last 15 or 20 years. They want an alliance without it being Western facing. They want to sell cars in all the capitals. They want to be everybody's friend. They want to be Switzerland when it comes to foreign policy. And one of the things that I tried to push and President Trump tried to push is to say, you don't get to do that. You're Germany. Americans have made lots of sacrifices for Germany, and we expect the Germans to be Western-facing, not some of the problem countries in Europe. And so that relationship, I think, was always trying to be one of reminding the Germans that they have responsibilities to the West. And, you know, sometimes we had members of the German cabinet that were really supportive, that encouraged me to be stronger and more potent. And then other times they would say, no, you know, we want to just be Europe, and we're done with this kind of Western alliance of picking fights. I think the war in Ukraine has changed them. I think that there's a flipping of the policies and they realize that they have to be more Western. They haven't quite said Donald Trump was right, but I hear it.
Yeah, a political question for you, Rick, to finish up today. And that is, the Democrats seem to be seizing on the Roe versus Wade over being overturned as like their saving grace for the midterm elections. I have my own thoughts on that, but your kind of reaction to that, that will somehow, people will ignore inflation, this foreign kind of insecurity for Roe versus Wade.
Well, first of all, I don't think anyone's going to ignore inflation or gas prices. But to the extent that the Democrats want to make abortion the issue, Republicans have an opportunity to make abortion the issue and show the world that the Democrats are radical. You look at other countries around the world and nobody wants late-term abortions. It's very unpopular. Governor Newsom here in California is making a move to enshrine it into the California Constitution. I've made it clear if he tries to do that, we will fight him hard, because I don't believe pro-choice Californians want to see late-term abortions. Let's have that debate. And I think that they lose this when we are able to talk about the issues and what they're trying to put forward. Let's be very clear with what they're trying to do.
Rick, as always, we appreciate it, both the international insight, the foreign policy insight, and the political insight. As always, thanks, Rick, for joining us. And Rick, of course, is part of our team at the ACLJ.
I will tell you, like, we're not like a lot of organizations in that we don't have, you know, we get some, and we're appreciative of everything. We don't get regularly $10 million grants and $1 million grants. That's very rare for us. But it's because of people like you. Lots of people like you. Thank you. Without your support, it doesn't happen. And as we said, we're in a matching challenge campaign. Jordan's going to let you know how to do it. It makes a big difference.
It's very easy to do. You go to ACLJ.org. That's ACLJ.org. You'll see matching challenge or donate. Either one of those take you to the right page. So you go to ACLJ.org. This is a great time to support our work. As you said, we're grassroots. You know, a $25 donation is a big deal for the ACLJ.
Everyone, taking your calls at 800-684-3110. We're going to go right to Jerusalem, where our leader of our Jerusalem office, Jeff Balaban, is right now. And Jeff, there's a lot in the news. There's a lot to talk about. Let's kind of unpack it one at a time. We just had a report, for those that were watching on our social media platforms, about what is going on with Iran and their nuclear capabilities, and this big concern that they have advanced significantly. Yet at the same time, we're finding out that the United States is in these sort of talks with the Iranians in Doha, Qatar, about still trying to get into this Iranian nuclear deal. What are you hearing on the ground now that you're in Jerusalem?
People are absolutely stymied. They're trying to figure out, and they're asking me as an American, what on earth this administration can be thinking. You know, if you wanted to destabilize the Middle East, destroy all of America's interests, side with brutal dictators over their people, encourage massive global terror, and ultimately give nuclear weapons to the enemies who declare that America is the great state and Israel is the small state, this is exactly what you would do. So why are they doing it? And that's what people are asking. They're asking me for the answers. They don't see the answers.
Yeah, so here's the question, though. You know, of course, the United States is not doing these directly, right, Jeff? I mean, this is the subterfuge of all of this. They're doing this through, what do they call it, intermediaries, third-party governments. But why would you put, I mean, it makes no sense to me with all the progress that was made in the Middle East with the Abraham Accords and so many other issues. You and I were there for the embassy move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. These were historic moments, and the Middle East did not explode. In fact, to the contrary, things got much better and much more stable. But now you give Iran this kind of rope, and then you have Saudi Arabia, who now has relations with Israel, Jordan, Egypt, UAE, a lot of the other Gulf states are saying Iran with the nuclear weapon will wreak havoc in the region and will be deadly, literally, and they are the largest state sponsor of terror.
Look, okay, I don't want to play amateur psychologist here, but all I can think of is, and this is what I'm telling people who ask, is this is consistent, not with America's interests, but with the left's utopian vision of themselves as masters of the universe. It's the same thing as pretended they're going to change the climate and defeat a virus. And, you know, it seems to be their ideas. Wouldn't it be great and demonstrate how godlike we are if we could rehabilitate the Muslim Brotherhood and the mullahs in Iran and the Palestinian Authority and make them not terrorists, but peaceful statesmen, and we're going to solve the world. Okay, that's great, except what it actually causes in real life is massive destruction, bloodshed, death, and it destroys America's interests as well as any of our allies. And you're right, Jay. We just saw spectacular success with the Abraham Accords. And yet they seem to want to walk exactly in the opposite direction.
So you got this shift going on. You had the previous talks with the Iranians were mostly done by the Europeans and Russia as an intermediary. Go figure that one out. And now, and those were in Vienna. Now they're using Qatar as the intermediary. How dangerous do you think this is, Jeff? I think it's on a road to disaster.
Exceptionally dangerous. Look, and I said this the last go around when the Obama-Biden administration was moving in this direction, you know, forget about the nuclear warheads for a second. The fact that Iran already has intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBM, they don't need them to reach Israel. They can use them to reach Chicago. And we need to recognize that Iran openly states its desire for our destruction all the time. And we have more and more evidence, thanks to Israel, by the way, thanks to Israel and their missions, their dangerous missions to reveal what Iran actually, how they've been cheating, et cetera. We have evidence of how much they've been lying and cheating throughout. So why do we want to go back in there again? Yes, Jay, it is dangerous. And besides the ultimate danger for us in America, of course, this means massive increase of funding of terror and destabilization, especially in the Middle East, but often around the world.
All right. So I want to go to the domestic situation politically in Israel, because obviously big news last week with the government falling, so to speak. What is the latest development there?
Maybe we need to actually explain to people how the government works.
I think that's
in Israel,
a really good idea, Logan.
Because I think that we hear the headlines, and look, sometimes I'm confused. So
right.
Maybe we need to break it down a little bit, because we're so used to American politics.
Yeah, it's not a constitutional republic in Israel, Jeff. So I think it's Logan actually is right. Let's start from the beginning here and describe
we
this
coalition.
It's more like the British system, this coalition government. How does it work?
So here, you don't vote for like the two major parties and you don't have direct elections for a party. There are numerous parties and people vote for numerous parties. And then the parties have to see, based on how many mandates or seats they have to be in the Knesset, in the parliament, try to group together to get a majority of 61. Okay. And that's where the fun begins, because the coalition building is then becomes a lot of horse trading. For me, it always resembled the most in American politics what the Appropriations Committee looks like, where the Democrat-Republican matters a lot less than deal-making. And so it's the ultimate deal-making. And for the first time, the last government or this present government was formed by a couple of groups on the right breaking in completely new direction and actually forming a government with Arab parties. Now, there have often been Arab members of parliament. That's not a surprise in Israel. But these are parties that are not pro-Israel parties. These are parties that actually side openly with Hamas, a terror group, Muslim Brotherhood parties. And so it was a shocker when supposedly extreme right-wing Zionist parties formed a government with them, and people thought it wouldn't last. And for a year, it lasted with a lot of tension. And then it looked like things were beginning to collapse. And Bibi Netanyahu, who has been the opposition leader because he couldn't form a majority government last time, looks like he was gaining power because the right was realigning, saying they don't like the current situation.
We know that it could fall like on a moment's notice, right? I mean, it could just literally fall apart, which it did because some of the coalition partners pulled out. Where is it now? There's a lot of talk that Netanyahu may be coming back and trying to put his own coalition together. Does that look realistic or not so realistic right now? What does it look like? You're there.
It looks highly realistic. A lot of the schism that existed among the right, which is to say the national religious parties, the Zionist parties, the secular Zionist, the pro-Israel parties, I guess we would call it, even though a lot of the other side here may call themselves pro-Israel, they don't like what they've seen in the last year. They think certain red lines were crossed. And so even though some of them may have issues with Bibi Netanyahu's dominance, and he's been a major the major dominant political figure for decades, it seems they may be aligning, and that's the hope. And that's actually, but it's by no means clear that that will happen, because there are a lot of personality issues and there are a lot of personal political futures at stake. So it's a race against time to see if Bibi Netanyahu can put together a coalition of majority. And that's actually why the current government are the one who called for this government to stop, so that they have a chance to quickly reestablish it and not allow Bibi to have a little more time to call for the government to end, so that he could have already established his coalition. People are on the right generally are hopeful that Bibi will be able to pull it together again, but it is by no means certain.
When do you think we'll know?
Oh, I don't think we'll know for quite a while.
Months?
I wouldn't be shocked. And that's also when I'm talking to people here, including I talk to some of the best well-known political analysts on both sides of the political spectrum. And they are up in the air with this. It could happen anytime. It could happen quickly, or it can drag out possibly for a month, 3 or 4 months.
Your support of the ACLJ makes a huge difference. Any amount you donate to the ACLJ this month, we get a matching gift, which means, as we've said before, if you donate $20, we get $40. You donate $100, we get $200. We encourage you to do it.
Yeah, and as you said, I think the overturning of Roe obviously was a massive victory that a lot of us never thought we'd see in our lifetime. However, what that does is open up likely 50-plus, actually, territories and all that, 50-plus cases that could happen and that we'll be part of in each and individual states.
Even in pro-life states.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Because there's always, a lot of these states, the percentiles can go either way.
Yep.
All right. Again, support the work of the ACLJ. We are part of our matching challenge right now. Be a part of it at aclj.org. Any donation made is effectively doubled by a member who is ready to match your funds.